Just over a week ago, the Los Angeles Lakers won the 2009 NBA championship, title number 15 for the Lakers and an all-time record 10 for coach Phil Jackson. In his years with the Chicago Bulls and now the Lakers, some pro basketball writers dubbed Jackson the Zen master for urging his players to read philosophy. Now, more than a few call him the best coach ever. We will stipulate to Coach Jackson that many of you are great fans and admire his work. If you have an actual question for Phil Jackson, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Phil Jackson joins us now by phone from his office in Los Angeles. Nice to have you with us on Talk of the Nation. Congratulations.
Thanks, Neil.
And I wonder, have you now accomplished everything you've ever wanted to as a coach?
You know, I never really thought about that as an accomplishment. I mean, you think about it in accumulation, yeah, it's incredible. But, you know, you just think about, you know, going back and winning a championship. And then, you know, those championships seem to roll up in threes. When I was with the Bulls a couple times, with the Lakers here earlier. And then, you know, I basically left the scene, was off into retirement, and the Lakers were moving in another direction, but things didn't work out so well. And at the behest of the team, I came back to kind of bring them back to, you know, stability. They missed the playoffs in 2005, and so, you know, here we are. 4 years later, we're back at a championship. So it wasn't really like a goal that I thought was ever going to be accomplished during this period of time.
Well, if they're coming in threes, you'd hate to leave and miss the next two.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Who can tell? That's a tall order for any team. One is as spectacular as you can hope for.
There are many comparisons drawn in the past few weeks between you and Red Auerbach, who, of course, won 9 championships with the Boston Celtics back in the day. Do you make any of those comparisons?
No, we're totally different people. And we had a very different agenda. We had a very different NBA to work under. His had, you know, obviously 8 teams, 9 teams, and 10 teams. And, you know, I started coaching there 28 teams, and now there are 30 teams. And so, yeah, that's a totally different agenda. Total of players that played NBA basketball at that time was under 100 players. You know, and now we have 3 times that number or more. And it's a worldwide sport, and that's a big thing. A lot of our players are from overseas. What Red did was remarkable was that he built a team, you know, from scratch. And I had an opportunity to come in and coach teams that were pretty well formed in a couple occasions, both in Chicago and in L.A. And so I just was able to guide teams to that promised land, so to speak.
When you were a player, people think you're ancient, but you're not that ancient. Red Auerbach was no longer coaching. He was president of the Boston Celtics when you were a player.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I'm sure you saw him on from the court side, and every once in a while, of course, you played on some great Knick teams, but Red would light the cigar when he thought the Celtics were about to win.
Yes, he was kind of the scourge of the NBA among coaches because there was certain sort of arrogance behind that, you know. He wasn't beyond going into a locker room and berating the officials' locker room after a ball game, and now you can't even discuss their competency without being fined by the league by a lot of money. So it was quite a different league at that time. But Red, very competitive guy, and also a great promoter of basketball. I know one of my teammates, Bill Bradley, you know, had maintained a friendship with Red, even though, you know, we were arc opponents against the Celtics in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, those were the Dave Cowens and John Havlicek teams that you and the Knicks played. You were more a role player on the Knicks, and I wonder, you played under another Red Holtzman.
That's
and
right.
How much did he shape your philosophy of basketball?
Well, my Red was, Red Holtzman was a guy who was unraveled or unrivaled in his ability to remain calm and cool. He was a guy that, you know, espoused the middle path, confusion way, you know, that, you know, everything should be taken, you know, on a sense of a level that was middle path, not too high, not too low, and you get through the day just fine. He was a very good manager of people. Never saw him draw a play, never drew a play on the paper. If he had a play or something he wanted to express on the blackboard, he'd call me up and say, Phil, go draw up one of those things that those guys run over there in whatever, Los Angeles or Boston or whoever we were playing. So there was kind of removed or an aloof attitude towards the game. He would end the huddles, which usually was 95% defense, with what do you guys want to run when you go out there on offense, and kind of leave it up to us. And I thought that was a remarkable thing to do, to kind of give, you know, credence to the players. We have so many coaches that are really controlling coaches in this game now, and he was one of the guys that really promoted self-reliance.
One more question I'll let the listeners have at you, and that is, you were on that first great Knicks team that won the championship. You were hurt that year and didn't play. The second Knicks championship team, you were an important part of that team, not a starter, but an important part. Did that championship ring mean more to you than perhaps those you've won as a coach?
Yes, I think that playing it gives you an understanding of what it takes to do this. And there's that certain sense of how much sacrifice players go to what ends they go through to win a championship. I mean, this day and age, we have 4 playoff rounds to get through. When I was playing, you know, we had 3. And the fourth one, you know, makes that championship season almost 7 weeks long. It drives on and on, you know, and players get hurt. Every game is so much more physical than any other game that you've ever played before. So it means a lot to have one as a player.
All right, let's get the callers on the line. Our guest, of course, Phil Jackson, coach of the world champion Los Angeles Lakers, winner of 10 championships as a coach in the National Basketball Association. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And why don't we start with Larry. Larry with us from Sheridan in Oregon.
Thanks for taking my call. Coach, I was just wondering, what role do you feel that a coach, a general manager, an owner, or a commissioner might have in disciplinary actions or in any action when players have off-court legal issues?
Well, I think that you're in a binding agreement because you're an association. So we all kind of fall under a uniform statute of, you know, what is harmful to this association. We have to maintain a certain protocol. That being said, commissioners can levy, you know, disciplinary action, suspend guys, whatever. As we've seen with Michael Vick, for example, is a case. And here, Manny, our great log Dodger here in L.A., has been suspended for some substance abuse in baseball. So those are some of the things that the commissioner has to do. I think, you know, my level of discipline has to do with what hurts a team, what overrides a team's best interests, as does a general manager or a vice president of a basketball organization. That's where our discipline happens. But, you know, we try to get players to be disciplined so that they can play together. So our fines start with if you're late. If you're late by, you know, a minute, you know, there's a silly fine. But if you're late by 5 minutes, then it goes to a major amount of money, you know, a considerable amount of money, because anybody could be late 5 minutes. And, you know, we try and, you know, emphasize the fact that it's the discipline that makes teams coordinate and do things together because of the group effort.
So would that imply that it is kind of win at all costs, as long as you just trust that the upper echelons are dealing with discipline and you just try and get the best player on the court regardless what his antics might be?
No, absolutely not. There's, you know, we always had the motto in Chicago that you don't draft talent. You don't draft character, you draft talent. You make sure that person has the talent, and then you hope that you get a talented player, because that's the key. Is, you know, talent can always be developed, but you have to have character, and we really have emphasized that in that department. But that being said, a lot of our kids come from areas of the country and situations that make them very determined and very competitive, just by the nature of how they've grown up. And so there's a lot of, you know, fine line between how far does discipline go, and I think that's the area you're trying to broach here, huh?
Larry, thanks very much. We'll give somebody else a chance.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to Brad. Brad with us from Detroit.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Coach. Congratulations on 10 championships.
Thanks.
You commented some years back that you enjoyed talking with Scotty Bowman, a longtime coach of the Detroit Red Wings. And I was curious, what kind of things would you take away from conversations with other coaches from other sports? And were there some specific other coaches that you'd liked to talk to from other sports?
Well, you know, Ari Grant, who coached the Chelsea team last year in the Superior League in soccer, you know, came over and watched a practice last year during the finals. And we talked a lot about the basics of the game. You know, a lot of what we do, what they do, is you displace the defense by moving the ball. It feels like 10 times larger in a basketball court, obviously. Hockey also uses, we always used to kid about hockey. Hockey's a give-and-go game. You know, there are very few picks and screens, but there are some things. But, you know, I grew up playing hockey in North Dakota as a kid when my parents moved from Montana to North Dakota. So in North Dakota, where I went to college, the University of North Dakota, that's their, quote, big sport. That's their major sport. And so I really relate to hockey and understand the game and know the nuances of it, so that, you know, when you talk about it, it's entirely different than someone that, you know, doesn't have an opportunity to know hockey or been to hockey games. I've been to a number of hockey games. Scotty and I talked about championships, what make championship teams and the characters that you have to have.
Hmm. Brad, thanks.
Great, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, bye. Let's see if we can get, this is Sam. Sam with us from Dayton in Ohio.
Yes, hi. Thanks a lot. I was thinking about Abe Maslow and the last article that you had about the good society and the better society and so on, and wondering if in the philosophy of teamwork, if he doesn't look at teamwork as the good team versus the bad team or the good team versus the better team.
I'm a member of, actually the spokesperson for the Positive Coaching Alliance. It's called PCA, and it's a national movement. It's probably 10 years old, and it's about promoting the game, you know, from the standpoint of positive,
yeah,
positive comments from coaches, positive comments from fans, positive behavior by parents in the stands. And a lot of what we talk about is, you know, that there are, all the teams are talented. It's the matter of discipline. It's the matter of team character that make the difference between teams. The talent level is amazing in this game.
Yeah. So it's not focusing on losers but winners.
That's a big part of it. And,
okay.
You know,
well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
All right, Sam, thanks very much. Here's an email that we have from Tijani, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Do you still assign book readings for your students? If so, what books are on the book list?
Yes, I do. And, you know, I gave them out or give them out, you know, during a long road trip when, you know, players have to spend, you know, 2 weeks, 9 days, you know, anywhere from that on the road in a 5 to 7 game road trip that, you know, might encompass, you know, coast-to-coast travel, long plane flights, late nights. And this is a different age. You know, there's very few kids that read books in our world, and the number of college graduates that play in the NBA has diminished by about 50% with you know, early outs and the number of international players that we have. But, you know, I seem to find books for everybody. We had a Chinese player, Sun Yue, on the team. I gave him The Good Earth by Pearl Buck this year. You know, a look at his society prior to the revolution. Pau Gasol, who's a, you know, a Spanish player on our team, I gave him Hemingway's book, The Sun Also Rises, a little book about, you know, the revolution, you know, in the 30s, but the in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So, I try to, you know, find an interest or a common denomination between, you know, the book and the player, so that we can relate to something that, you know, I know and he knows.
And now that you've got at least a couple of weeks to breathe a little bit, if you're coming back next year, what are you reading this summer?
You know, I have a book list that I have going on. I've got a Kindle. I'm planning to download a number of those books onto the list.
There's a few authors waiting for your plug.
Well, I'm not going to give that up right now, but you know, I do know that there's a Kingsolver book that I haven't read yet.
Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah, she's one of my favorite writers. I think she's terrific. And you know, I got a couple recommendations that I'm going to go back and look at. The history of Napoleon again that's been written that I think I want to read that is of interest to me. But you know, those are two of them, and you know, a lot of them books that are under the self-help kind of category in a bookstore. I often have one of those books going in the side, an early morning read or a late night read.
We just have a minute left with you, and there's been a lot of talk about the injuries that you've had to deal with. Were those from your days as a player, and do you talk to your players about the difficulties they may face in later life with the ailments they're going to have?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, we talk about it in the form of, you know, taking care of yourself, not playing too much at the end of your career, you know, what you have to do, the physical therapy that's available to them now, strengthening themselves during the off season so that they limit their injuries. All that goes into it. And, you know, we do a complete, you know, workup on these players before they have their exit meetings, which just happened last week. So we talk to them about their injuries that they've incurred or accumulated over their career or incurred the last year and how to, you know, work with them over the summertime so that they can rehab themselves and get themselves back in position. But it's a big part of it. You know, it's a big part of looking at some of these guys now that are turning 50, like Dominique Wilkins and, you know, the guys that, you know, were dunking those balls that were remarkable that are just the generation behind me, and seeing them go through the kind of stuff that I had to go through 10 years ago. So it's an interesting transformation.
Coach Jackson, thanks very much, and again, congratulations.
Thanks, Neil. I enjoy your show.
Thank you. Tomorrow, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us with a new trivia question. This is NPR News.